Did you direct him to return from Medina without delivering the consul's dispatches?
In a manner of speaking, yes, I did. I particularly impressed upon him the necessity for respecting Medina's neutrality, and this he could not have done had he entered into conflict with the French. I wholly approved his return. Had he entered the Goletta, he must have been captured.
You wholly approved his defeating a carefully planned stratagem? Are you not aware, sir, that the Dryad, or at least some similar vessel, was intended to be captured, and that within 5 minutes of receiving news of her capture and of the Frenchman's violation of neutrality, I should have detached a squadron to depose the bay and put in a friend of ours, at the same time clearing every French ship out of all the ports in his country? Had you no notion of this?
None whatsoever, sir, upon my honour.
Nonsense, said Hart. I made it perfectly plain.
No, sir, you did not, said Jack. You spoke in a general way about this being an important service, requiring particular discretion, which puzzled me, since the carrying of presents and consular dispatches did not strike me as a task calling for exceptional abilities. You also dwelt upon the necessity of respecting the Barbary State's neutrality. When I referred to my written orders, I found nothing whatsoever, not the slightest hint, that they were to be understood in a special sense, that I was to send a ship under my command into a trap and oblige her to be captured, perhaps with heavy loss. And I do not wonder at it, sir, said Jack, his collar rising at the idea of Babington hauling down his colours at last under overwhelming fire. I do not wonder that you did not give me a plain, direct order to send my friend in under such circumstances. On the other hand, my written orders did insist upon the respect due to neutrality, as did your verbal instructions. It was natural, therefore, to conclude that that was where the need for discretion lay. And I may say, sir, he said, looking Admiral Thornton in the eye, that I respected that neutrality to the very limit of human endurance. At some point in this statement, delivered with increasing force, the moral advantage changed sides. And now Jack Aubrey, sitting square in his chair, opened his orders at the relevant page and passed them to Admiral Thornton, saying, "There, I appeal to your candour, sir. Would not any man take that to be the heart of the matter? Scrupulous respect will be paid to the laws of neutrality." While Sir John put on his spectacles again and ran through the orders, Hart said that they were written in a great hurry, there not being a moment to lose, that he had not had time to read them over, and the clerk might have mistaken his drift, that a nod was as good as a wink to a blind horse, that he was nevertheless perfectly convinced that his verbal instructions had made his meaning clear. Anyone could have told that something was afoot when a 74 was sent on such a mission and told to keep a full day's sail away. Anyone could have told that the orders were to be obeyed to the letter. He had nothing to reproach himself with. It was disconnected, angry, unskilful, and somewhat embarrassing. Admiral Thornton made no reply, but said to Jack,
"International law must be obeyed, of course. Yet even Roman virtue can be overdone, and there is such a thing as being too scrupulous by half, above all in a war of this kind, with an enemy that sticks at nothing. Letting fly first with a broadside in the presence of witnesses is one thing. A scuffle ashore where the first blow might have come from anyone is another. Did it never occur to you to land a party of marines?"
"Yes, sir, it did. Indeed, Captain Harris himself put the suggestion forward in the handsomest manner. I am not very much holier than thou, sir, I hope, in matters of this kind, and I should certainly have done so if my orders had not insisted so upon respect for neutrality."
"They did nothing of the kind," said Hart. "Properly understood, they did nothing of the kind."
Nobody saw fit to comment upon this, and after a while Admiral Thornton said,
"Very well, Captain Aubrey. Although the outcome of this affair is unfortunate in the extreme, I do not think we can usefully say any more. Good day to you."
"Dear Lord above, sweetheart," wrote Jack in his serial letter, "I have never been so relieved in my life. All the way back in the boat I dared scarcely smile or even congratulate myself, and there was William Babington waiting for me with such a look of mortal anxiety on his face, as well there might have been, he having beheld the Admiral in the first full flood of his wrath. I carried him into the stern gallery, it being a sweet evening with a light breeze at south-southwest, and the squadron standing due east under t'gansels, so that we had a capital sunset spread out before us, and gave him an exact account of what had passed. We were as gay as a pair of schoolboys that have escaped a most prodigious flogging and expulsion, and we called Pullings and Mowat in to sup with us. I could not in decency open my mind to them about the Rear Admiral. I could not even say how painful it was to hear and see a man of his rank and age sounding and looking so very mean, so very like a scrub. But we understood one another pretty well, and Mowat asked me whether I remembered a disrespectful song the hands had made up about him when I had the dear Sophie. It was not the sentiment that Mowat objected to, he said, but the meter, which, it appears, broke the laws of prosody. Yet the sentiment was not wholly inoffensive either, since even the moderate chorus ran, bugger old heart, that red-faced son of a blue French fart, as Jack remembered very well. It was a charming supper-party, only wanting Stephen to make it complete, and even he will be with us, wind and weather permitting, in 2 days' time. For this morning the Admiral made my signal, received me kindly, no cold glare, no damned icy distance this time, no Captain Aubrey, or you, sir, and gave me very welcome orders to proceed to Port Mahon to take certain stores on board, and my surgeon, he having had leave of absence in those parts. The orders had in fact continued, "Now, Aubrey, I understand from Dr. Maturin that you are acquainted with the nature of some of his more confidential expeditions. He also says that he places the utmost reliance on your discretion, and had rather sail with you than any other captain on the list. At present his occasions take him to the French coast, something west of Villeneuve, I believe. You will therefore carry him to the most suitable point for landing, and take him off again as and when you shall, between you, think best. And I do most sincerely hope that you will bring him back safe, with the least possible delay." But obviously this could form no part of his letter, nor could another subject that dwelt in his mind, rarely quitting his immediate consciousness. He could, and did, skirt round it, saying,
"I do hope we have a brush with the enemy soon, if only to wipe out the fiasco at Medina. The officers and men who have sailed with me before know that upon the whole I am not wanting in conduct, nor, I believe I may say, in ordinary courage. But most of the ship's company know little or nothing about me, and I think some suppose I did not choose to fight. Now it is a very bad thing for men to sail under a commander they suspect of shyness. They cannot, of course, respect him, and without respect, true discipline goes by the board."
Discipline, as the essence of a fighting ship, was certainly very dear to Jack Aubrey's heart, but there were some things dearer still, and reputation was one of them. He had not had the least notion of how he valued it until both Harris and Patterson treated him not indeed with disrespect, but with something considerably less than their former deference. This was not immediately after his most unpopular order to leave the Frenchman lying there, when he knew very well that in the first flat anticlimax and disappointment, the letting down of very high-wrought spirits, the ship would happily have seen him flogged, but some days after Medina. The incident, if anything so evanescent and impalpable could be called an incident, was followed by a series of unquestionable facts. The appearance of several names on the defaulters list, charged with fighting, half of them former skates, half of them men who had sailed with Jack before. Naval justice was crude and amateurish, with no rules of evidence or procedure. But at this quarter-deck level, with the grating rigged for immediate execution, it was not calculated for delay, still less for concealing the real causes at issue, and quite often the truth came out at once, naked and sometimes inconvenient. In this case it appeared that the skates, comparing Jack's conduct with that of Captain Allen, their last commander, maintained that Captain Aubrey was less enterprising by far.
"Captain Allen would have gone straight at em," says he, "law or no law. Captain Allen was not near so careful of his health or his paintwork," he says, "so I fetch him a little shove, or a nudge, as you might call it, to remind him of his manners."
This evidence explained the battered appearance of many hands who were not charged at all. Bondon, Davis, Martins, and several more of Jack's lower-deck friends, even placid old Joe Place. The equally battered appearance of a number of marines, as well as former skates, and the increased animosity between soldiers and seamen. It also led Jack to notice, or to fancy he noticed, changes in the attitude of some of his officers, a lack of the perhaps somewhat exaggerated awe and respect that they thought due to the genuine salamander's reputation that had surrounded him for so many years, that had made his work so very much easier, and that he accepted as a matter of course. All this Jack could have put in his letter, and he might even have added his reflection about a man's losing his reputation, and a woman's losing her beauty, and each of them looking right and left for signs of the loss in much the same manner, but it would not have told Sophie much about her husband's real trouble, which was a dread that he might, in fact, have behaved cowardly. He had a profound belief in the lower deck's corporate opinion. There might be a good many fools and landlubbers down there, but the seamen predominated not only in moral force but even in number, and in matters of this kind he had hardly ever known them to be wrong. He had had no great heart for the fight in the first place, none of those tearing spirits and that joy and intense anticipation, like fox-hunting at its best, but fox-hunting raised to the 100th power, which had preceded other actions. Yet that was neither here nor there. A man could be out of form without being chicken-hearted, and he had certainly sought out the enemy with all possible zeal, directly offering a close engagement with the odds against him, and even trying to provoke it. On the other hand, he remembered his relief when he understood that the Frenchmen were not going to fight. An ignoble relief. Or was ignominious the word? Not at all. It was a perfectly reasonable relief at not having to throw an ill-prepared, unseasoned crew into a desperate fight, in which so many of them must certainly be killed, wounded, crippled, maimed. In actions of that kind there was always a most shocking butcher's bill, and with such a crew it would have been even worse, to say nothing of the strong possibility of defeat. As for his refusing to land the marines, on first recollection it had seemed to him perfectly innocent, decided in perfect good faith, his orders being what he had understood them to be. But the Admiral's words had shaken him horribly, and by now he had argued the matter over with himself so often that what with accusation and indignant denial he could no longer tell just what the true nature of his intention had been. It was obscured by argument. Yet in this matter intention was everything, and there was no point in putting the case to any other person on earth. Sophie, for example, would certainly tell him that he had behaved correctly, but that, though agreeable, would be no real comfort to him, since even she could not get inside his head, or heart, or vitals, to inspect his intentions as they had been at that moment. Nor could Stephen, for that matter. Still, Jack looked forward extremely to their meeting, and in something less than 2 days' time, when the Worcester rounded to under Cape Muller, unable to enter Mahone Harbour because of the northwester, he took his barge, pulling through the narrow mouth, and then beating right up the whole length, board upon board, although an exchange of signals with the officer in charge of Royal Naval Stores had told him that nothing but a little Stockholm tar had yet arrived for the squadron. This was water that he and his coxswain, and at least 4 of his bargemen, knew as well as Spithead or Hamoaze, and they sailed up with a kind of off-hand cunning, shaving past the Lazaretto, catching the back eddy by Cockold's Reach, a spacious stretch in these warm latitudes, and slipping through the hospital channel, censuring all changes that had been made since their time. Not that there were many. The Spanish flag, rather than the Union, flew over various public buildings, and now the Spanish men of war in the harbour were not prizes to the Royal Navy, but allies. Yet upon the whole, little had altered. The place still had much of the air of an English Georgian market town and seaport, set down in an incongruous landscape of vines and olives, with the occasional palm, and a brilliant Mediterranean sky over all. As they sailed along, Jack pointed out the various places of interest to the youngster at his side, such as St. Philip's, the powder mill, the ordnance wharf, and the mast yard. But the gangling boy, a spotted first voyager named Willett, was too much awed by his company, too eager to be ashore, and perhaps too stupid to absorb much information. And as they drew nearer to the town, Jack fell silent.
"We will have a pint of sherry at Joselito's, for old time's sake," he said to himself. "Order a handsome dinner at the Crown, a beefsteak pudding, a Solomon Gundy, and those triangular almond cakes to finish with. And then walk about, looking at the places we used to know, until it is ready." And then to Bondon, "Captain of the Port's Office."
The barge glided along under a high wall on the far side of the harbour, a wall with a discreet green door leading to the Dove House where he and Molly Hart had first made love. The wall was dotted with capers, growing wild in the interstices of the stones. They were now covered with their strange, feathery flowers, as they had been on that occasion, and his mind was still ranging back with a mixture of lubricity and tenderness and indefinite regret when the barge sprang her luff and touched against the opposing wharf at the Capitania steps.
"Jump up to the captain of the port, Mr. Willet," said Jack. "Give him my compliments and ask where the doctor's victualler lays. Her name is Else Set Dolors."
"Yes, sir," said Willet, looking appalled. "Else Set Dolors, it is, sir. What language shall I say it in, sir?"
"Spanish or French, and if that don't answer, you may try Latin. Bondon will go with you."
"The captain of the port's compliments, sir," said the returning Willet, "and the Set Dolors lays off La...
"Dargana," said Bond.
"But Dr. Matcham is gone to—"
"Tudadla, on a mule."
"And they do not look to see him back before Sunday evening."
"Asking your pardon, sir," said Bondon. "Saturday, I believe."
"He said Sabbath, though," cried Willet.
"So he did, sir. But the Sabbath is on Saturdays in these parts, we find. Sunday they call Dimancho, or something very like." "Thank you, Mr. Willet," said Jack, deeply disappointed. "However, I think we may as well have our dinner here, before returning to the ship."
He reflected for a moment, his eye on the unattached ladies gathering at the waterside. He had put half a guinea of the boy's allowance into his hand before leaving the Worcester, and although Willet was neither amiable nor intelligent, Jack did not wish him to buy a pox with it.
"Eldon," he said to the grizzled, hard-faced bow oar, "Mr. Willet will have dinner at Bunce's, and then you will show him the sights of Mahone, the Ordnance Store, the Careenage, the Proving Ground, and the Protestant Church. The slips, if there is anything a-building, and the madhouse, if there is time before 6 o'clock.
He arranged with Bondon for the bargemen's dinner, told them to draw straws for boat-keepers, and walked off unattended. Sentimental pilgrimages had rarely succeeded with Jack Aubrey. In the few that he had ever deliberately undertaken, something had nearly always happened to spoil not only the present, but much of the past as well. Yet it now seemed that perhaps this might be an exception. The day itself was brilliantly clear, as it had often been when he was in Minorca as a lieutenant and a commander, and it was warm, so that climbing the steps to the upper town he unbuttoned his coat, a far finer coat than that which he wore in those days, but one that did not prevent him from being recognized and welcomed at Joselito's and the other places he called at on his way to the Crown. Port Mahone still showed many signs of the long English connection. Quite apart from the officers and men from the 3 Royal Navy vessels in the harbour, 2 sloops and a gun brig on convoy duty, pink faces and hair as bright yellow as Jack Aubrey's walked about the street. Tea and even buns were to be had, as well as English beer and tobacco. And at Joselito's there were copies of the London papers not more than 2 or 3 months old. But the high days were gone, the days when the whole Mediterranean fleet lay in Port Mahone, and powerful garrisons filled St. Philip's and the Citadel. The Royal Navy now relied much more on Malta and Gibraltar. The Spanish Navy kept only a couple of brigs in Mahone, while the troops amounted to no more than a few companies of local militia. So it was understandable that the town as a whole should seem rather sleepy, while the places that catered chiefly for sailors and soldiers should have a somewhat deserted air. Jack walked into the Crown by the back way, through a courtyard full of orange trees, and there he sat on the stone rim of the fountain in the middle to draw breath and cool himself after his walk. His cold was gone long since, but he was out of form, and in any case walking on the hard, unyielding land after weeks and months of having a live deck underfoot always made him gasp. From an upper window came the voice of a woman singing to herself, a long flamenco song with strange intervals and Moorish cadences, often interrupted by the beating of a pillow or the turning of a bed. The throaty contralto reminded Jack of Mercedes, a very, very pretty Minorcan girl he had known in this same inn before his promotion. What would have happened to her? Swept off by some soldier, no doubt, a mother many times over and fat, but still jolly, he hoped. The song ran on, a lovely, dying fall, and Jack listened more and more attentively. There were few things that moved him as deeply as music, yet he was not all ears, all spirit, either, and in a long pause, while a bolster was thrust into a case too small, his brute belly gave so eager a twinge that he got up and walked into the tap-room. a broad, low, cool, shadowy place with vast barrels let into its walls and a sanded floor.
"You bloody old fool,"
said a parrot quietly in the silence, but without real conviction. Jack had known this place so thick with tobacco smoke that you could hardly tell one uniform from another, and so full of talk that orders had to be roared as though to the foretop. Now it was as though he were walking in a dream, a dream that respected the material surroundings to the last detail but emptied them of life, and to break the spell he called,
"House! House there! La casa, ho!"
No reply. But he was glad to see an enormous bull mastiff come in from the hall, making the first marks in the newly sprinkled sand. The Crown had always had fine English mastiffs, and this one, a young brindled bitch, with a back broad enough to dine on, must be a granddaughter of those he had known very well. She had never seen him in her life, of course. She sniffed his hand with distant civility, and then, obviously unimpressed, paced on to the patio. Jack stepped into the hall, a square hall with two staircases and two English long-case clocks in it, the whole full of brilliant sun. He called again, and when the echo of his voice had died away, he heard a distant screech of
"Coming!"
and the patter of feet on the corridor above. He was contemplating one of the clocks, made by William Timmins of Gosport, and ornamented with a creditable ship of the last age, a ship that still carried a lateen yard on the mizzen, when the pattering feet reached the staircase on his right, and looking up he saw Mercedes coming down. An unchanged Mercedes, still pigeon plump, but no vast spreading bulk, no moustache, no coarseness.
"Why, mercy, my dear!" he cried. "How happy I am to see you!"
And stepping to the foot of the stairs he stood there with open arms. Mercedes paused a moment in her course, and then crying,
"Capitan Maniac!"
flung herself into them. It was as well that he was a powerful man and well braced, for Mercedes, though slim-waisted, was a solid girl, and she had the advantage of the height. He stood the shock, however, the padded, scented shock, and having squeezed the breath out of her body, he lifted her up and gazed at her face with great complacency. Pleasure, freshness, gaiety, and peach-like bloom he saw there, and he kissed her heartily, a delighted, frankly amorous kiss, heartily returned. Kisses were not unknown at the Crown. Jack and Mercedes had exchanged them before now without the roof falling in, but these set off a very shocking hullabaloo. Both clocks struck the hour. The front door and two windows slammed with a sudden gust of wind. Four or five bull mastiffs began to bay, and at the same moment the hall filled with people coming in from the street, or the courtyard, or down the other flight of stairs, all with messages, or questions, or orders that had to be shouted over the hollow roaring of the dogs. Mercedes banged and thumped the mastiffs, dealt with the questions in English, Spanish, and Catalan, and between two of them she told a boy to lead the captain to the Mermaid, a particularly comfortable little room up one pair of stairs. And in this little room, the Crown grown calm again, they sat very companionably together, eating their dinner at a small round table, the dishes coming up hot and hot from the kitchen by a plate hoist let into the wall. Mercedes ate much less than Jack, but she talked much more, very much more. Her English had never been accurate. It had slipped with the years, and now her rather wild remarks were interrupted by bubbling laughter and cries of
"Cat's English, maniac! Kitchen cat's English!"
Nevertheless, Jack perfectly understood the essence. Mercedes had married the Crown, a man much older than herself, a poor, thin, pitiful, weak-hammed cat as avaricious as a badger, who had only made the offer to spite his family and save her wages. He had never made her a single present, and even her ring was found to be brass, and therefore neither valid nor binding. Whereas the present Jack had given her long ago, yet not so very long ago neither, was close to her heart at this very moment. She had put on a new pinner for the occasion, and now undoing it, she leant over the table, showing him the diamond pendant he had bought for her in the year 2, one of the many charming fruits of a valuable prize, nestling low in her bosom. The Crown, that sordid creature, was away for some days in Barcelona. Jack would have his old room, no doubt. It had been new hung, with crimson curtains.
"Oh, damn me, Mercy dear," he cried. "I'm a captain now, you know, and must not sleep out of my ship."
Could you not even be allowed a little siesta after all that duck pie, and the day so hot?
Asked Mercy, gazing at him with wide, innocent eyes. Jack's face, somewhat more florid than usual, with fish soup, lobster, lamb chops, duck pie, Minorcan cheese, and three bottles of wine, spread in a rosy smile so wide that his bright blue eyes vanished, and Mercedes knew that he was about to say something droll. So he would have done, too, as soon as he had hit just the right balance between not sleeping and indelicacy, if Stephen had not made the most unwelcome entrance of his life. They had heard his harsh, disagreeable voice on the stairs, and Mercedes had had time to spring up and adopt the attitude of one waiting at table when he walked rapidly in, smelling of hot mule.
"Good day to you, young gentlewoman," he said in Catalan, and then, without the slightest pause, "Come, brother, drink up your coffee. There is not a moment to lose. We must run to the boat."
He seized the water jug, drained it, recognized Mercedes, and said,
"Why, Mother of God, it is you, child. I am happy to see you. Pray run for the reckoning, my dear. The captain must leave this minute. Is it a guest you have?"
he asked Jack, observing the two places laid.
"No," said Jack. "That is to say, yes, most certainly, of course. Stephen, let us meet at the boat in a couple of hours' time. It is no good before then. I have given a youngster leave. He cannot be left behind."
"Jack, I have run my poor mule nearly to death. You may certainly maroon a midshipman, 10 midshipmen.
"Then again, I have some important communications to make to a friend here."
"Are these communications of the very first importance to the service, Tell?"
"They are more of a personal nature, but—"
"Then let us hear no more of them, I beg. Would I have rid the cruel long road from Tudadala in the heat of the day? Would I drag you from your coffee and your company and drink none myself if there were no imperative haste? If it were not more important than amiable communications, or even than spouse breach for all love? Come, child, the captain's hat and coat and sword, if you please. Duty calls him away."
Duty was obeyed, but with a sullen and a reluctant step. And it was clear to the coxswain and crew of the barge, hurriedly called from Thorio's skittle alley, that they had better watch out for squalls. A glance at their captain's closed, forbidding face, a glance at one another, with an almost imperceptible jerk of the head or movement of an eyelid, and all was understood. The bargemen sat in their places, prim, mute, and correct as a Sunday school, while Bondon took the boat right down the harbour with a strong, favourable breeze, and the officers sat silent in the stern sheets. Jack's silence was that of extreme disappointment and frustration. Stephen's that of a mind busy far away, preoccupied with motives and probabilities in the first place, and then with questions of the distances to be covered by various men and the time required for their journeys. That morning he had received word of the meeting he and his colleagues had been working for, a meeting with men high in the service of the French and their allies that might lead to very great things. The meeting itself was confirmed, but to enable an important officer from Rochefort to attend it had been put forward 3 days. All the factors that Stephen could check agreed that the appointment could be kept by those on land, but there remained the Worcester's ability to carry him to that obscure, marshy rendezvous, and as soon as they were in the fore cabin he said to Jack,
"Pray, Jack, could you set me down at the mouth of the Aiguille by Tuesday evening?"
"Where is the Aiguille?"
asked Jack coldly. Stephen turned to the chart-table and ran his finger along the low, flat coastline of Languedoc, with its salt lagoons and brackish marshes, canals and small, unnavigable rivers choked by sandbars, meandering through malarial fens, and said,
"Here."
Jack looked at the chart and whistled.
"As far as that?"
cried he.
"I had supposed you meant something in these parts. How can I possibly answer for such a distance unless I can foretell the wind's direction and its force? Above all, its direction. It is not quite foul at present, but it might haul forward until it is directly in our teeth any minute. Dead on end, as they say. I wonder at your asking such a simple question. You must know by now that with the best will in the world a ship cannot lie closer than 6 points, and the Worcester will not come up so near. You must have heard of leeway. Somebody must surely have told you of leeway, and—"
"For God's love, Jack, just point the ship in as near the right direction as ever you can, and tell me about leeway afterwards. There is not a moment to be lost."
These words had so often been addressed to him during his years in the navy that even in his present hurry of spirits he was pleased to be the one who uttered them, and he repeated,
"There is not a moment to be lost."
"Do you wish me to slip?" asked Jack seriously.
And to make his meaning even clearer,
"To slip the cable, leaving it and the anchor behind?"
"Would that save much time, sir?"
"Not above a few minutes in this clean ground."
"Then perhaps we should retain our anchor," said Stephen. "That invaluable implement, a precious standby."
Jack made no reply to this, but went on deck.
"I am afraid I have vexed him, the creature,"
said Stephen to himself, and then sank back into his former train of thought. Half-consciously he heard the fiddle on the capstan head, the stamp and go of the men at the bars, a strong cry of, "Heave and rally!" The fiddle increase its tempo, and then the even stronger cry of, "Heave and away!" 2 minutes later, with the anchor catted, the Worcester was making her ponderous way close-hauled for Cape Mola under topsails, driver, and jib, swaying up her t'gallant masts as she went. As soon as she was well clear of the headland, she took the true breeze, undeflected, a moderate tramontane, and Jack, standing by the helmsman with the master, said,
"Luff and touch her."
Up she came, spoke by spoke, until the weather leech of the main topsail began to shiver.
"All the bowlines!" called Jack.
"One, two, three, belay up!"
The traditional howling chant came from the fore, main and mizzen gangs, in exact order and with immense spirit. And from the forecastle Mowat roared,
"Bowlines hauled, sir!"
with equal zeal, for Mowat, like all those who had sailed with Jack Aubrey in the Sophie, was used to these sudden departures from Mahone. In those days Jack had private sources of information about the sailing of enemy merchantmen, and the Sophie would dart out to play havoc with French and Spanish commerce at a moment's notice, sending in prizes to such an extent that at one time Holborn's Quay had no room for any more, and they were obliged to be moored in the fairway. It was then that the Sophie's commander came by the nickname of Lucky Jack Aubrey, and his enterprise, good fortune, and accurate intelligence had brought all the Sophies a great deal of money, which they liked. But even without the prize money, or with much less of it, they would still have loved these cruises, the long-drawn-out chase with every possible turn of seamanship on either side, and then the capture, piracy with a clear conscience. And now, the word having spread from the former Sophies to all the present Worcesters with its usual electric speed, the hands hauled the bowlines and sharped the yards with far more than common energy. Jack noticed it, of course, just as he noticed Pulling's eager, questioning eye, and with a pang he realized that he was going to disappoint them all once more.
"Luff and touch her!" he said again,
and the Worcester, braced so as to look as like a fore-and-aft vessel as her nature would allow, or indeed rather more, came nearly half a point nearer the wind. He studied the angle of the dog-vane, called for an azimuth compass to take the bearings of the wake and of Cape Mola, gazed long at the sky, the familiar, clear, tramontane sky with high white clouds moving in a steady procession toward Africa, and methodically began to pack on sail, causing the log to be heaved every 5 minutes. Returning to the cabin at last, he said to Stephen,
"If the breeze hold true, and there is a fair likelihood of its doing so, I may be able to carry you to the mouth of your river in time by making 3 legs of it, the last profiting by the indraught close to the shore. But you are clearly to understand that at sea nothing whatsoever can be guaranteed."
He still spoke in a somewhat official tone, looking taller than usual, and stern, and even when Stephen had made all proper acknowledgments he went on in the same captain's voice,
"I'm not sure what you meant by saying spouse breach at the Crown just now, but if it means what I think it means, allow me to tell you that I resent the imputation extremely."
Denial was on the tip of Stephen's tongue. Denial, or a rapid though necessarily fallacious explaining away. On the other hand, it was exceedingly difficult to lie successfully to so intimate a friend. In the event he only had time to pass his tongue over his lips once or twice like an embarrassed, guilty dog, before Captain Aubrey stalked out of the cabin.
"Such asperity," said Stephen to himself. "Dear me, such asperity."
He stayed leaning over the chart for some time, studying the lines of approach to the hidden rendezvous. His colleagues and agents used it more often than most of their meeting places in the southern parts, but he had not been there himself for many years. He remembered it well for all that, a lagoon at the river's mouth, then beyond it a great dike dividing salt marsh from fresh. Far along the dike, on the left hand, a shepherd's hut by one of those vast buildings where wintering sheep were housed by night, and a rarely inhabited shooting box. Away on the right hand, the village of Mandiag, almost depopulated by malaria, Malta fever, and conscription, but still served by an indifferent road. The whole, even beyond the distant village, deep in reed beds, a paradise for duck, wading birds in great variety, mosquitoes, and the bearded titmouse. "The bitterns may have arrived," he said, partly to still an uneasiness that would keep rising in the depths of his mind. And he returned to his own part of the ship. Here he found his assistants, and together they looked at the Worcester's sparsely inhabited sick bay, a camel bite, some broken bones, checked their accounts, and mustered their stores. Mr. Lewis had dealt with the medical situation perfectly well in Stephen's absence, but there was a most unfortunate deficiency in the portable soup and port wine intended for invalids. They and two Winchester quarts of liquor ammoniae acetatis had quite certainly been stolen by some criminal hand as yet unknown, misled by the liquor part of the label.
"Once he starts upon it, we shall certainly know," said Mr. Lewis, "and we shall no doubt recover what he and his messmates have not drunk. But the port and the soup are gone for ever. It was my own fault for not screwing them to the deck, and I shall have to make them good out of my own pocket. My one comfort is that there is said to be a monstrous fine prize in prospect that will enable me to do so without beggaring myself and Mrs. Lewis, that will perhaps enable us to set up a carriage. Ha ha! What do you say to that, sir?"
"Nothing do I know of the future, Mr. Lewis," said Stephen, "still less of the immediate past. What is this Barker where the camel bit young Williams?"
Lewis told him about Barker in detail, and about Medina, ending,
"And so, all in all, sir, and by and large, and taking one thing with another, I believe I may say that I have rarely seen a ship's company so deflated, is perhaps the proper word, seeing that the martial afflatus it was that was gone, nor more discontented with their officers, and the no doubt necessary state of affairs, nor more divided and apt to disagree. The two fractures and the tooth cases certainly arose from that, whatever the parties themselves may allege, nor more inclined to pick and steal. But I have no doubt that this prize will wipe out the sense of failure and set everything to rights. Our younger Loblolly boy is messmates with two old Sophies, and they tell him that Captain Aubrey never set out from Mahone in a hurry without bringing back a prize. Never, they swear, not once. And if he did that with a 14-gun brig, what will he do with a ship of the line? A galleon is the least I reckon on. More probably two."
"Mr. Lewis," said Stephen, holding up the lantern to see the pure gleam of cupidity more clearly, "you forget we are no longer at war with the Spaniards."
The gleam faded, then came obstinately back with the reflection that vast wealth was still carried by sea, even if galleons were gone.
"Remember the Hermione," cried Lewis. "The surgeon's share alone was above £4,000.
Stephen went thoughtfully to bed. That is to say, his cast of mind was thoughtful, and so was the expression on his face. But in fact he was so tired after his furious morning's ride on a more than ordinarily wicked mule that he could neither govern nor direct his thoughts. Notions, ideas, and statements presented themselves in no apparent order, with no apparent connection. This Medina business certainly explained some of Jack's asperity. What kind of rhinoceros was it that Lewis described as having a prehensile upper lip? How far was La Reyniere, a sub-agent in Montpellier, to be trusted? How had he, Stephen, come to say spouse breach at the Crown? The imputation was certainly true. It was also certainly impertinent, unwarranted, ill-bred, an unpardonable freedom. Was it impatience and fatigue on his own part, or a lurking jealousy at the sight of that fine, melting, amorous wench? In any event, it was inaccurate, and since Mercedes was now married, this would have been double. Spouse breach. His eyes closed upon the word three times repeated, like a spell. Long, long and late he slept, waking with a delicious sense of ease, his body moulded into the cot, almost immaterial. He lay for an indeterminate stretch, luxuriating, until an abrupt recollection of what the Worcester was carrying him to wiped the warm, benign, dozing pleasure from his face. At the same moment he saw his door open gently, and Killick put his long red nose through the crack. How Stephen knew that Killick was doing so for the sixth or seventh time he could not tell, but he was as sure of it as he was sure of the words that Killick did then pronounce. If the doctor happened to be awake, the captain would be glad of his company at breakfast. Then the unexpected addition,
"And then he rode. There was something he did ought to see on deck."
Jack had been on deck in the middle watch, and again before dawn, when the breeze freshened. What little sleep he had had, and he was used to short snatches, had been deep and refreshing. The searching wind, right cold by night, and the driving spray had done away with much of his ill humour, and although he had held back his real breakfast until Stephen should be awake, an early mug of coffee and a piece of bread and honey in his hand had restored much of the usual sweetness of his nature.
"Good morning, dear doctor,"
he said as Stephen came blinking into the brilliant light of the quarter-deck.
"Look at that. Ain't it prime? I do not believe that with all your experience of the sea you have beheld the like."
The quarter-deck was crowded. All the officers and all the young gentlemen were there. There was a general atmosphere of excitement, and Stephen noticed that his particular friends were looking at him with a kindly triumph and expectancy, as though amazement might knock him flat at any moment now. He gazed at the pale blue morning sky, the darker white-laced sea, the quantities of sails. He was most unwilling to expose himself before so many comparative strangers, most unwilling to disappoint his friends, and with all the conviction and astonishment that could be summoned on an empty stomach, he cried,
"I do not believe I ever have. A most remarkable sight, upon my word."
"You can see 'em even better from the Hanses,"
said Jack, leading him to the side, and carefully following the admiring gaze of all eyes on the quarter-deck, Stephen perceived an array of overlapping triangular sails along the bowsprit, and beyond it, well beyond it.
"There," said Jack, "there you have the whole shooting match. Four of the topmast staysails, of course, inner jib, outer jib, flying jib, spindle jib, and jib of jibs."
He explained to Stephen at some length that after long experiment he had found this answer best with the Worcester's present trim, and with the present light breezes. He named a large number of other staysails, the spanker and driver, pointed out the total absence of square sails on the main and their rarity elsewhere, and assured Stephen earnestly that by so shifting the centre of rotation he was able to make good a course as close as six true points, so that now, with really able seamen at the helm and a prime quartermaster at the conn, she could eat the wind out of any 74 of her class.
"When you have gazed your fill, come and eat breakfast with me. I have some prodigious fine Menorca bacon, and will set things in train."
He hurried away, and Pullings came up to wish the doctor a good morning, and congratulate him on having seen such a spectacle.
"Now you will really have something to tell your grandchildren," observed Mowat, and pointing upwards he added, "and you must not forget the mizzen t'gallant staysail, whatever you do."
"I served 8 years with Sir Alan Howarth, and I do suppose he was the greatest flying kite man in the service," said Collins. "But in all that time I never saw the whole shooting match, not all at once."
Stephen wondered how long he must in decency go on staring at the whole shooting match. He smelt bacon, he smelt coffee, he slavered.
"Mr. Pullings, my dear," he began,
but at that point the jib of jibs saw fit to part company with its sheet, and in the turmoil Stephen slipped away. They were still breakfasting in the lavish naval fashion when the mate of the watch came bounding in, rather ahead of Jack's permission to do so.
"Mr. Mert's duty, sir," he cried, "and there are 4 sail of merchantmen fine on the larboard bow."
"No men of war, Mr. Honey?"
"Oh, no, sir. Great, fat, greasy merchantmen all huddled together.
In the gaiety of his heart Mr. Honey laughed aloud, turning it into a cough when he met his captain's cold eye. Jack dismissed him and said to Stephen,
"I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint them cruelly again. But if we're to be off the mouth of the Aiguille by tomorrow evening, there is no time for whoring after prizes."
"I beg pardon, sir," said Mert in the doorway, "but I'm afraid Honey did not report quite right. There are 4 sail of merchantmen fine on the larboard bow, one of them very large, and if we do not alter course they will be windward of us in half a glass. May I put the ship about?"
"Are you quite certain they are merchantmen?"
"Dead certain, sir," said Mert, grinning wide, an amiable wolf.
"Then our course must still be east-northeast. A half east."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
said Mert, with creditable fortitude. "East, northeast, or half-east it is." The light left his face, and he left the cabin.
"There," said Jack. "I was afraid of it. A fine 12-hour chase, with all hands on deck and every stitch of canvas set and drawing and the bow guns playing long bowls, would have pulled the people together wonderfully after the letdown at Medina. You have heard of it, Stephen?"
"I have, too, at intolerable length."
"I was obliged to disappoint them there, or so I thought. They have never been the same since. And for my part, I have been most hellish ill-tempered, wake up angry in the morning, vex all too easy throughout the day. Tell me, Stephen, are there pills or draughts against the blue devils and ill-temper? I am most damnably hipped these days, as I am afraid you have noticed."
For a moment he thought of telling Stephen about the suspicion that dwelt in his mind, but recollecting what kind of rendezvous his friend was to keep, he only said,
"If you have finished, Stephen, pray smoke away. I am sure you bought some of your best mundungus in Mahone."
"If you are sure you really do not find it disagreeable," said Stephen, instantly feeling in his pockets, "I believe I may. For me, tobacco is the crown of the meal, the best opening to a day, a great enhancer of the quality of life. The crackle and yield of this little paper cylinder," he said, holding it up, "gives me a sensual pleasure whose deeper origins I blush to contemplate, while the slow combustion of the whole yields a gratification that I should not readily abandon even if it did me harm, which it does not. Far from it. On the contrary, tobacco purges the mind of its gross humours, sharpens the wits, renders the judicious smoker sprightly and vivacious, and soon I shall need all my sprightliness and vivacity."
"I wish to God you were not going," said Jack in a low voice.
"There is no option," said Stephen. Jack nodded. To be sure, Stephen's landing in some remote creek had as little free choice about it as Jack's carrying his ship into action. Yet there was something so horribly cold-blooded about the creek, cold-blooded, dark, and solitary. He hated the idea, yet he drove the Worcester towards the place where the idea should become reality with all the skill he had acquired in a lifetime at sea. He drove her and her people hard, with jibs and staysails perpetually flashing in and out, and with the utmost nicety of weather helm, himself standing at the conn, watch after watch. The Worcesters were mystified, but those who understood seamanship were deeply impressed, and those who did not were still so much affected by the sense of grave urgency that they too jumped to carry out all orders. He drove her so hard that in the event he made his landfall with hours to spare, intolerably dragging hours in which the Worcester stood on and off and the sun crept down the bright western sky. It set at last in a long golden blaze, and the ship ran in on a kind but untrustworthy breeze, bringing the darkness with her. Yet still another hour had to pass before she was close enough to send a boat off to that flat, desolate shore, and that hour was as burdensome as 10. All the preparations had been made, the letters written, the recommendations repeated several times. Jack fussed with the dark lantern, the blue signalling flare, the pistols, and the patent device for striking a light that Stephen was to take with him. Jack also added a clasp knife and a few fathoms of stout line.
"I have renewed your pistol, Flints," he said again.
Again Stephen thanked him and looked at his watch. Only 7 minutes had passed. "Come," he said, walked over to his cello case, and said, "let us improvise." They growled and squeaked for a few minutes and passed the rosin to and fro. Then Stephen struck out a phrase from a Haydn symphony they had heard together, a strange, haunting, inconclusive phrase, a faintly questioning voice from another world. Jack repeated it. They played it in unison once or twice, and then handed it back and forth with an infinity of variations, sometimes by common accord playing together, sometimes separately. Neither was an excellent player, but each was competent enough to express much of what he wished to express, and they so conversed without a pause until Puddings came in to say that the ship was in 10 fathom water and that the cutter had been veered astern. After the lit cabin, the deck seemed impenetrably dark, apart from the glow of the binnacles, and unseen hands guided Stephen to the ladder. The Worcester carried no top lights, her great stern lanterns were cold and unlit. The scuttles and stern windows of cabin and wardroom had been carefully screened, and she was whispering gently towards the even darker shore through an unseen sea, her sails ghostly overhead. People spoke in undertones. Stephen heaved himself up onto the rail. Someone farther down the ladder set his searching feet on the first rung. He felt Jack's hand reaching for his, shook it, and made his way down into the boat. A moment later, Mowat said, "Shove off." The Worcester's tall stern moved smoothly on, even darker than the general night, shutting out a great stretch of star-filled sky.
"Give way,"
said Mowat, and in a moment the boat was quite alone. The breeze was coming off the shore, loaded with the scents of land. Marsh reek, the smell of dew on reeds, the general smell of green. It was a long pull in, but they took it easy. The moon would not rise for above an hour. Nobody spoke, and Stephen found that sitting there in the darkness, with the rhythmic plash, the heave, and the sense of motion, but of motion quite unseen, had the quality of a dream, or more exactly, that of another state of consciousness. Yet presently his eyes grew used to the night, and he could make out the land quite clearly. The starlight seemed to grow stronger, although clouds were drifting across the Milky Way, and he recognized several of the boat's crew. Recognized them more from their general shapes than their faces, however, or in the case of Fintram Spelden, by the depraved old wool hat from which he was never parted. All sober, discreet, solid men. Bonden, of course, he had known from the first.
"You have your cloak, doctor?"
said Mowat suddenly.
"I have not," said Stephen. "Nor do I feel the need of it. Sure, it is a warm, even a balmy night."
"So it is, sir. But I have a feeling the wind may back into the south. Look how those clouds turn and tear. And if it does, we shall have rain."
"The doctor is sitting on his cloak," said Bonden. "I stowed it there myself."
"Now you can see the tower pretty clear," observed Mowat after a while.
Stephen followed his pointing hand, and there indeed the dark tower stood out against the sky, a square Roman tower built when the sea stretched 5 and even 10 miles inland. They said no more until they heard the small waves breaking, and saw the faint line of white stretching out on either hand.
"We are just about a quarter of a mile south of the bar, sir," said Mowat in a low voice, standing in the boat while the men rested on their oars. "Would that answer?"
"Perfectly, I thank you," said Stephen.
Mowat said,
"Give way. Stretch out now."
The boat sprang into motion, moving faster and faster until it ran tilting up into the sand, checking with a hissing kiss. The bowman leapt out with a gangboard. Bonden led Stephen over the thwarts, said,
"Mind your step, sir,"
and he was ashore in France. 5 minutes, while Bonden struck a shaded light, lit Stephen's dark lantern and closed it, hung his other equipment round his neck in a little cloth bag, and made him put on his boat cloak. Then Mowat said very quietly,
"But half after 4 tomorrow morning in the same place, sir. All failing tomorrow, the blue light at midnight, and the next day at dawn."
"Just so," said Stephen absently. "Good night, you know."
He walked up the slope in the yielding sand, and as he went he heard the rattle of the gangboard, the boat's kiss in reverse, and the stroke of oars. Where the dunes began, he stopped and sat down facing the water. He could see the lapping wavelets as they ran up the shore, and the stars reflected for a great way out, and the horizon. But no ship anywhere at all. Nor even the boat. The only sound was the wind over the dunes and the lapping water down there. It was, in a way, the world at the very beginning, the elements alone, and starlight. He was extremely unwilling to move. The sense of personal invulnerability that helped at the beginning of the war had left him long ago. He had been a prisoner the last time he was in France, and although he had come away unharmed, at least 2 of the French intelligence services had identified him beyond any possibility of a doubt. If he were taken now, he could expect no mercy at all. He could not hope to come away untortured or alive. In earlier days he had faced much the same kind of fate, but then there had always been a certain chance of deceiving the other side or of escape, and in those days he was not married. His aims were single-hearted, and in any case he cared less about his life. Directly before him a glow appeared at one point of the horizon. It grew brighter, still brighter. and then the rim of the moon heaved up, almost painfully brilliant to his night-accustomed eyes. When it was clear of the sea, a gibbous, lumpish moon, he held his watch to his ear, pressed the repeater stem, and counted the minute true chime. Both the watch and the moon told him that it was time to go, and standing up he paced deliberately down to the water's edge, where the wet sand not only made walking less laborious, but also held no lasting trace. Twice he stopped to argue with his unwillingness, and each time he looked out along the moon's path on the water. Nothing whatsoever upon the sea, near or far. The bar at the mouth of the Aiguille lay before him at last, a broad strip of sand strewn with bleached tree trunks, for except at times of flood most of the river stayed in its lagoons and marshes, the rest reaching the sea by a channel no wider than a man could leap. As he came to it, he startled a night-heron fishing under the steep two bank, and for some reason the loud, harsh, familiar cry as it flew off, black and white in the moonlight, was a comfort to him. He made the leap successfully, whereas a few moments earlier he had been afraid that the bodily awkwardness that so often accompanies fear might make him blunder. And when he reached the far bank of the river he saw the two lights he was to look for. Two lights, one above the other, far away in the direction of the shooting box. His gentleman was there, and exact to the time, but to reach him Stephen must skirt the lagoon, following a fisherman's path to a wooded knoll, and then strike across through the reed beds for the dyke, passing three small pools on his way. At this end the path was clear enough, and firm underfoot. It led him round a tongue of dry land, to a shallow inlet full of wading birds that fled away with desolate, fluting cries. And indeed, although the marsh gave an impression of silence, silent water gleaming under a silent moon, there was in fact a good deal of sound quite apart from the soughing of the wind in the reeds. Over on his left he could hear the sleepy gabble of flamingos, goose-like but deeper. Duck flew overhead quite often, their wings creaking. And at the far end of the reed beds that he must traverse to reach the dyke, perhaps a mile away, a bittern began its foghorn song, boom, 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 as regular as a minute gun. He reached the knoll, an island once, with its tumble-down hut and the eel-traps hanging in a willow tree. There were rabbits here, and while he was searching for his landmarks, he heard one taken by a stoat. On and into the reed beds. Here it was night again, with very little moon coming down through the long leaves overhead. There was a path, of sorts, and his lantern, unshaded now, showed him a cut reed here and there, but much of the way he had to push through, sometimes striding high over dead or fallen stems, often ankle-deep in ancient-smelling mud, always too hot in the cloak, and sadly plagued by the mosquitoes he disturbed in his passage. And in any case, there was little certainty about the path. Others crossed it, or merged with it, or forked off, confusing the direction. These were certainly made by wild boars, and at one point he heard a band of them moving about, snorting. But boars did not interest him very much. What almost frivolously occupied the top of his mind, riding above his eagerness for the meeting and its success, and above his deep and sometimes almost paralyzing sense of fear, was the bittern. He was going directly towards it. The sound was astonishingly loud by now, and he thought the bird might be at the edge of the reeds, fringing the next pool, whose far end was formed by the dyke itself. If only he could move quietly enough, and if only luck were with him, he might see it standing in the moonlight. Though indeed the moon would not last much longer. Every time he looked up out of his dense cover he saw more and more clouds in the sky, and although he could not be sure of the direction, they now appeared to be coming from the south. As far as luck was concerned, it seemed to be with him, decidedly with him so far, for although it was impossible to move without at least some rustling, he was getting closer and closer, so close now that he could hear the bird's hoarse, straining indraft and the small private note that preceded the enormous boom. The bittern did not mind the noise he made, and perhaps mistaking him for a boar, it did not even take fright when a false step sent him splashing knee-deep in the mud. But when a high, nervous voice called from the reeds ahead, "Atla! Kiviv!" it instantly fell silent, although it had taken a full breath.
"Le Docteur Ralph," answered Stephen.
The voice made the agreed reply,
claiming to be Voltaire, though from the sound it was clear to Stephen that he was an agent named Leclerc.
"I expected to find you on the dyke," he said,
examining Leclerc as the moon shone bright through parting clouds. Leclerc explained that he had heard movements on the farther marsh, and that he had felt too visible perched up there. Only cows, perhaps, but possibly poachers or smugglers. It was a great place for smugglers, and it was wiser not to call attention to himself. He had left the horses at the shooting box, not liking to ride out, they being so nervous tonight.
"I do not wonder at it," said Stephen to himself. "If they have caught half your hurry of spirits, they must be fit to take to the air."
Leclerc was a clever fellow, but Stephen would never have chosen him for this assignment. He was a townsman through and through, and townsmen were often ill at ease on a marsh or a mountainside by night. Besides, he had the wrong temperament entirely. They were on the dyke, and from here the farther marsh could be seen, mostly rough pasture criss-crossed with shining ditches, but with clumps of tamarisks and taller trees here and there, as well as great stretches of reed, and in places one could make out the windings of the road to Mandiargues and the canal of the same name. As they walked along, Leclerc named the men who had arrived at the rendezvous by the time he left, and he was speaking of those who were still expected, when two large, pure white shapes rose into the air from just under the dyke.
"Oh, my God!"
he cried, clutching Stephen's elbow.
"What was that?"
"Egrets," said Stephen.
"And who else, besides Pangloss?"
"Martineau and Egmont, as well as the Durors. It is too many altogether. I was against it from the start. There is always the possibility of an indiscretion, an accident, and gathering so many people, some of whom we hardly know, in such a place as this."
"Hush,"
he whispered, in an urgent voice, thrusting Stephen behind a clump of reeds.
"What is that?"
"Where?"
"On the corner, where the dyke turns to the left. It moves."
In the shifting moonlight, it was difficult to be sure of anything, but after a while Stephen said,
"I take it to be a gate-post with an owl upon it. There, the owl has flown. Pray put your pistol away."
They walked on, Leclerc speaking of the organizers of this rendezvous with the waspish malignancy of a frightened man, and the gate-post proved to be, in fact, a lightning-blasted willow tree. But they had scarcely passed it. They had scarcely turned the corner before there were shots in the marsh below them, a few hundred yards to the right. An exchange of shots from two separate places, orange stabs of flame in the darkness, crashing in a reed bed over towards the road. A moment's stunned silence, and Leclerc cried,
"We are sold! Betrayed!"
and set off at a furious run towards the shooting box. Stephen slipped from the dyke and into the reeds, where he stood, listening intently. What he heard puzzled him. It was more the sound of a skirmish with both sides running off, rather than that of a determined engagement or a pursuit. A good deal of sporadic shooting and then silence. An indistinct drumming sound, perhaps the galloping of horses a great way off, then nothing more. The clouds finally overcame the moon and the night grew almost wholly dark. The south wind, which had been blowing for some time in the higher regions of the air, now came in gusts across the marsh, making a noise like breakers in the tall reeds, and bringing with it the first small sweeps of rain. The bittern began again, answered by another a great way off. Stephen pulled the hood of his boat cloak over his head, against the drips. When he had waited so long that it was certain that Leclerc was not coming back either on horse or foot, Stephen climbed onto the dyke again. He now had to walk, bowed against the strong south wind, but even so it was far below, and he wanted to get away as soon as ever he could, back to the dunes before any organized search was possible. Although he was worried by the thought that this wind might very soon work up such a surf that no boat could take him off, the deep and at times almost disabling dread that had been with him earlier had gone. It was less fear than anger, then, that he felt when he was walking along a stretch of dyke with water on either side of it, and he saw a faint light ahead, a moving light, but moving far too steadily for a will-o'-the-wisp, and too clearly defined. Almost certainly a lantern like his own, a dark lantern, slightly open. He was unwilling to slip down into bare water of an uncertain depth, and there were no reed beds for several hundred yards. Indeed, this was a singularly bare stretch, the only shelter being some stunted tamarisks. Rather than retreat, losing distance, he plunged into these, and with his hood drawn over his face to hide the whiteness, he crouched there waiting for the light to pass. As it came nearer, he became more and more convinced that it was carried by one man alone, not a party, and that this one man was not a soldier. His step was hesitant and slow, and sometimes he stopped altogether, though he did not appear to look round or search the marsh on either side. Nearer, and Stephen lowered his eyes. A strong gust of wind, a squall of heavy rain, and clapping his hand to his hat, the light-bearer stepped under the lee of the tamarisks and sat down. He was 3 yards from Stephen and a little beyond him. He sat there hunched with his back to the wind until the rain stopped as suddenly as it had begun. He stood up, and they might well have passed if he had not suddenly sat down again, opening his lantern wide to inspect his naked foot. It was covered with mud, but as he wiped the dirt off with his handkerchief, a red flow covered the white skin. He tried to staunch it with his neckcloth, and in the reflected light Stephen saw Professor Graham's face, closed and hard with pain, but unmistakable. Chapter 8. Once again the flagship made the approaching Worcester's signal, requiring her captain to repair aboard. And once again Jack Aubrey sat primly on an upright chair in front of the Admiral's desk, but this time he did not sit so near the edge. His conscience was as clear as the pure Mediterranean sky. He had brought mail from Mahone as well as stores, and there was no hint of iciness in the great cabin.
"And so, learning that the greater part of the spars had not arrived, sir," he went on, "I had the less scruple in complying with Dr. Maturin's request that he should proceed to the French coast without delay. Fortunately the breeze served, and I was able to set him ashore at the appointed place and time, and to take him off the next morning, together with the wounded gentleman, the Mr. Graham. We carried out as far as Port Mahone."
"Well, I am heartily glad you have brought Maturin back so soon. I was anxious for him. He is aboard? Very good, very good. I shall see him directly. But first, tell me what they have sent us in the way of spars. I should give my eye teeth for a comfortable supply of spars."
Jack provided the Admiral with an exact, detailed account of the spars in question, and the Admiral gave Jack his views on the overmasting of ships, particularly of wall-sided ships in the Mediterranean, or anywhere else for that matter. While he was doing so, Dr. Maturin and Mr. Allen sat in the secretary's cabin drinking Marsala and eating Palermo biscuits. Stephen, however, was not reporting to Mr. Allen, very far from it indeed, but rather offering remarks upon the unfortunate results of divided councils, with his own recent expedition as an example.
"A bitter example you could not wish," he said, "for here you have a dark marsh with difficult, obscure paths, a pretty figure for this kind of warfare. And over these difficult, obscure paths you have 2 bodies of men approaching one another in the black night, both moving to much the same rendezvous, both actuated by much the same motives, but neither knowing of the other's existence. They blunder into one another, mutual terror, foolish terror, flight, and the utter ruin of at least 1 carefully elaborated plan, to say nothing of the suspicions of indiscretion, if not of downright treachery, that make the renewing of contact almost impossible." "The man, Graham, must be a great fool," observed Allen, "a busy, pernicious fool." "I have expressed myself badly, I find," said Stephen. "I intended no reflection upon the individual, only upon a system that allows still another department of government to set up an intelligence service of its own, working in isolation from the others, and sometimes in its ignorance even directly against them. No, no, Professor Graham has shining parts. He was the gentleman responsible for the capitulation of Colombo, which made such a noise in its time."
Allen was a newcomer to intelligence in this restricted sense, and he looked surprisingly blank for so clever a man. His lips silently formed the word Colombo 2 times, and Stephen said,
"Allow me to refresh your memory.
When that Bonaparte seized Holland, we seized, or attempted to seize, the Dutch possessions abroad, including, of course, those in Ceylon. The fortification of Colombo, the key to the whole position, threatened to present insuperable difficulties, particularly as the garrison was Swiss. For as the world in general knows, the Swiss, if duly paid, are not easily dislodged, nor yet bribed, persuaded, or overawed. Furthermore, the place was commanded by Hercule de Meuron, a Swiss officer of the most eminent military genius, but he was also an acquaintance of Mr. Graham's, a close acquaintance, as I understand it, even an intimate. Graham proceeds to Colombo disguised as a Turk, enters into contact with Meuron by means of a message concealed, elegant stroke, in a Dutch cheese, reasons with him, convinces him, the Swiss march out, the English march in, and Bonaparte is denied the resources of Ceylon. What means Graham used I do not know, but I am morally certain that it was not money. He must be an eloquent gentleman. To be sure. But my immediate point is that he is also eloquent in Turkish. He is a Turkish scholar, and that is why I have brought him, so that he may be presented to the Admiral. A trustworthy Turkish scholar would be unspeakably welcome, a godsend. At present we have to make do with the most pitiful ancient one-eyed Greek eunuch, Dupont's Christomathy. But would Mr. Graham ever consent to serve? Mr. Graham has no choice. He quite understands that in natural justice he is now my property, my lawful prize. And when I desired him to remain aboard rather than leave the ship at Mahon, he submitted without a murmur. After all, poaching on my preserve, the enemy coast, he undid all my careful legitimate web, and I took him off that coast at very considerable inconvenience to myself, since I had to prop him for miles through an evil bog, and very great danger indeed to those devoted souls who came in through the surf, and such surf, at the very minute of appointed time, while the horse patrols were already searching the dunes, the country having been aroused by all that foolish running about and banging in the night. 9 several times they had to come in, now sideways, now backwards, at infinite peril, before they could fetch him away, and he lashed to a grating, 3 parts smothered in that universal roaring foam. Professor Graham still looked, if not 3 parts smothered, then at least very humble, very much reduced, when he was first brought limping aboard the flagship. His spirits revived a little when he was away from Stephen, whom he had so injured and to whom he owed such a burden of gratitude. But although he held a chair in no mean university, it was long before he could recover his academic pride and sufficiency, since every time he put his stocking on or off, he was reminded of his ignominious wound, for stumbling with a cocked pistol in his hand, he had blasted off his little toe. Yet in the flagship, he was once again the king of his company as far as moral philosophy was concerned, to say nothing of Turkish, Arabic, and modern Greek, and once more he was surrounded by the navy's perhaps somewhat excessive respect for erudition, particularly classical erudition, and Stephen, coming across from a Worcester that had settled back into the monotonous routine of blockade, found a Professor Graham who had settled back into at least the appearance of his habitual self-esteem.
"I am come, on behalf of the Worcester's wardroom, to invite you to dinner tomorrow," he said.
"Honest fellows," said Graham, "I shall be happy to see them again so soon. I had not looked to visit the ship before the performance."
"Hamlet is delayed once more, I am sorry to say, but the oratorio is in great forwardness. Mr. Martin has come across several times to put a final polish to the shriller parts, and I believe we may hear it at last on Sunday. We expect a numerous audience, Mr. Thornton having signified his approval."
"Very good, very good. I shall be happy to be among them, and I shall be happy to dine with the Worcester's wardroom again, a home-like gathering. It is still the same nest of genteel harmony, I make no doubt."
"It is not, sir. As every schoolboy knows, the same grove cannot contain 2 nightingales, nor can the same wardroom contain 2 poets. It most unhappily appears that Mr. Rowan, whom you will remember as the gentleman who attached you to the grating, sees fit to set up in rivalry with Mr. Mowat. And what Mr. Rowan may lack in talent, he makes up in facility of composition and in fearless declamation. He has a considerable following, and the young gentlemen repeat his verses more readily than Mr. Mowat's. Yet he is not satisfied with his performance, and this morning he showed me these lines," said Stephen, pulling a roll of paper from his pocket, "desiring me to correct them.
and if at the same time I could furnish him with some learned expressions, he would be uncommonly obliged. For various reasons I declined the honour, but seeing his candid, ingenuous disappointment, I said that the squadron contained no more learned man than Professor Graham, and that if he pleased, I should carry the verses with me to the flagship. He was delighted. He submits himself entirely to your judgment, and begs you to strike out whatever does not please.
Mr. Graham pursed his lips, took the roll, and read, "But on arrival at the fleet's anchorage, there, a very sad story we next did hear, that Buenos Aires had been retaken, and our little army very much shaken. But a small reinforcement from the Cape induced the Commodore to try a feat, to reduce Montevideo was his intent, but which proved abortive in the event."
"You have begun at the end," observed Stephen.
"Is the beginning of the same nature?" asked Graham.
"Rather more so, perhaps," said Stephen.